listeners. You're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We're your hosts, Sam Collier
and Sarah Cho. And for this week's episode, we read the play Between Riverside and Crazy by Stephen Ali Gyurgis. It's a play about an ex-cop and recent widower, Walter Pops Washington, who struggles to hold on to one of the last great rent-stabilized apartments on Riverside Drive. He must also contend with old wounds, new house guests, and a final ultimatum. It was written with such humor, tenderness, grit, and wonderment. It is an extraordinary new play about a man trying to maintain control as the world unravels around him. It was a critical hit when it premiered off-Broadway, and the play was awarded the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. And that's what we do around here on this show is we read Pulitzer Prize plays. We're just crossing off the list. We got into the 2020, and then on 2019 or whatever. Now we're down to 2015.
Do you think we should go back and read like the plays that won the Pulitzer in like 1945? Just to change it up a little bit.
I mean, we could go that far back. But I think there'll be a lot of problems.
<I'm just kidding. laughs> All right. We'll discuss it some other time. Stay tuned, folks. So Stephen Ali Gyurgis obviously has written a lot of plays. I have only ever seen a reading of one of his other plays, which is The Motherfucker with the Hat. I haven't read anything else. What about you, Sarah?
This is my first play of Stephen.
All right.
Yeah.
So so he's also written Jesus Hopped the A-Train, The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. And he's a former co-artistic director of Labyrinth Theater Company. He's won a bunch of awards, including, as previously stated, the 2015 Pulitzer Prize. So let's just jump into our first impressions of this play.
So I'm going to coin a term here if it hasn't been coined yet. And I'm going to call this play a dysfunctional trauma comedy. And I'm going to call it that.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, this play really there was, first of all, so much of the comedy, there was like this layer of like the comedy, you're laughing at the lines and the reaction and stuff, but the characters themselves, they're all like, I feel like they were just all going through something traumatic, and then that's like developing dysfunctional relationship amongst all of them. And so I'm going to coin the term dysfunctional trauma comedy.
I love it. And I feel like because of that, because we're able to see what each of them is going through, we feel compassion for all of them, mm-hmm. even though they're in such conflict. Like you can see where everyone is coming from, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was clear to me, especially those scenes, like we have Walter or Pops, the center, mm-hmm. and his relationship with each one of these characters, with Junior's girlfriend Lulu, and I guess Junior's friend Oswaldo, and I thought it was funny or interesting how they all call him dad, or you know, like he's definitely a biological father to Junior, and then his relationship with Lulu, which is basically his son's girlfriend, she calls him Pop or Dad too. Like she's sort of like the center of this family that's kind of not really all biological family, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a layer of that is like Oswaldo, how he feels about Pop's. But then, like, his own his relationship with his father is, like, dysfunctional. Like, he doesn't really have a good relationship with his father. So it's almost like he's dependent on Pops in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, Pops is like the hub, kind of, and all these characters are rotating around him.
Yeah.
Or revolving around him.
In the beginning, you're kind of like thinking, oh, so like, oh, the way it's read, if you didn't know this play, you weren't reading the description, you're like, Oswaldo, is this his dad? But like you find out he's not his dad. And it's Junior that comes in and like, oh, there's like a whole other relationship dynamic. Every time a character came in, it was like another dynamic of this, these relationships, a map of relationships.
Yeah, I really like that. How first you see Pops and Oswaldo and you're like, okay, they're the father's son. And you find out that's actually not right. And then Lulu comes in and she keeps calling him dad. And you're like, oh, she's his daughter. And then he's like, why is she calling me dad? And you're like, oh, okay, that's not right either.
Right.
That was kind of delightful.
Yeah. And I think that's where that's the comedy, like this twist and turns of like surprises that you didn't expect, like that catches you off surprise. So you're kind of laughing at this absurdity.
Yeah, it was a very funny play. There's so much comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were that your first overall impressions of the play?
Yeah, I think I agree. I noticed how everyone has some kind of trauma right away, and I really like the character of Pops. I found him really funny, and I don't know, just the wit in this play is so fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And then I started thinking about all the things that are like kind of missing. So like the wife / mother who died in January, I think. How like there's a wheelchair, her wheelchair is still there, even though it's summer and she's gone. Her absence is so apparent and feels like such an important presence in the room. And then they keep talking about this dog, like go walk the dog, or this dog is, I don't know, codependent or whatever, but you never see the dog. So I thought it was really interesting how there were these, I don't know, like both the mom and the dog were like somehow people kept talking about them, and or they were really important, but they were never present on stage.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I guess we'll just like already started, but like what we noticed, what popped for us, definitely the father-son relationships and like Pops in the center. Lulu's pregnancy also popped for me.
Yes.
Lulu, she's pregnant and creates this like disruption in the relationship with Junior. And then it just made me kind of want to know about like, okay, well, this pregnancy, like watching how it kind of like pushed that relationship, like kind of escalate in a way. And another thing for me I was wondering about or popped for me was that kind of just like Junior's there's something of mystery about him. Like I don't think there was a really clear or like understanding like why his like he always felt so distant from everybody in some way. Like like going to Baltimore, or, you know, he's like wanting some distance from Lulu and like doesn't want pregnant. Like it was kind of like in a sad way of like we know that he just got off parole and so he has like this history with the law, and then so but like he just felt like one of like a very sad character to me.
Yeah. How old do you think he is? Do we ever hear?
I don't think so. But I feel like he just read a little older. Like
yeah, well he's cuz he spent some time in jail.
Yeah.
And he's like clearly doing some kind of trade with this, like all these I don't know, electronics out of his bedroom or something. He's selling things secondhand. But I don't know. Yeah, so I just had the sense of like maybe mid-20s. I think older than that.
Yeah. I was like thinking, yeah, like 20s, 30s.
Yeah, because I guess it, his father seems pretty old.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Maybe older than that.
And yeah, there's just something about his character, Junior's character, where it's like there's no sense of he can't really move forward or something in his life.
Yeah.
And there's just something about that and his relationship with his father. The father, he's kind of stuck in from moving forward too, you know, so it's like if the father's kind of stuck here and Junior's sort of wanting, like having to take care of his dad. So he's right. kind of trapped in that. And Lulu can't really, you know, the pregnancy is like this idea, like, oh, we're moving forward in our relationship. She even mentioned that in the, you know, like when the character says, like, are you guys married or engaged? Like, well, no, but we're like, we talk about our future, you know?
Right.
There's a sense of like, she can't really move forward. He can't really move forward. And because maybe Pops can't move forward. They just all sort of stuck in their circumstance.
You mentioned the pregnancy and I love how it's like ambiguous. I mean, she says she's pregnant and then Pop starts talking about it. She talks about it with Junior. And then this church lady, who's like a fake church lady, we find out, but she's like, oh, she's not pregnant. And then that like calls into question the whole thing. Like, was she ever pregnant? Did she get an abortion? I just found that fascinating. I was wondering.
Yeah.
Like, what is he doing with that? That she says she's pregnant and turns out she's not pregnant. Or like, is the church lady lying in that moment and then later she does get an abortion? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels that part feels unclear to me. Another thing that I mean noticed was the two cops. It's like Lieutenant, was it? Yeah, Detective O'Connor and Lieutenant Caro, which both are like engaged.
Yeah.
And O'Connor's like, again, another like seeing Pops as like a father figure, where it's like, I want you to walk me down that aisle, you know?
Right,
like, I want you
to walk.
So it's like, it is just so funny how everyone, how they view Pops. But then through these two cops, these two officers, we learn, this is like really good plot device of like, we learn why Pops is in his current situation of like, he's sort of in his home. He got shot and there's like this whole, I guess like a litigation or something going on. Between the city and him. So there's this whole like lawsuit going on outside of this home, like outside of this family, which I felt like really escalated the tension even more.
Yeah, because they want him to sign in. They just want him to settle. Yeah. Yeah, what do you make of that, that everyone sees him as this father figure, like even his coworker, former coworker see him as this father. Like everyone's coming to him with these expectations of what he's going to be for them or what he'll do for them.
Yeah.
And he, it seems to me like he's really uncomfortable with that. He doesn't, I mean, like he's not inviting that.
So when I was reading this play, the thing that came to my mind a lot was it really made me think about the kids and the youth that I've, you know, worked with and interacted with and had classes with and kids inside the juvenile halls. And a lot of the writings and just like a common theme, just like this is just, I don't want to generalize or oversimplify this, but just something I've just noticed amongst these youth is like two things that common themes I find in their writings and the things that they talk about is like wanting to be a good dad because they don't have a dad. Or, you know, some of them are already parents. And so they're like, I want to be a good dad for my kid when I'm out of here. You know, there's something that which made me really think about like class in a way, like this, because this place, the setting is like this one of the only, what is it, like rent controlled apartments. Mm-hmm. And they could only they're about to get kicked out of this home. And then like what a father represents is like a provider, right? Or that's just sort of the idea that we've come up with, like a father provides, a dad is there, you know, to be that head of the household. Mm-hmm. And so when Pops, he's not like fully functioning because he's obviously, we know that he's going through some like a trauma. He's grieving. His wife passed away. Like he's alone. And it's like, there's, because of that, there's this instability that everyone who sees him as Pop, and then that they're unstable because he's unstable. And there's something there I was like, made me a lot think about connecting with just families in general. Like, you know, what does like an absent of a parent mean? How does that, you know, to a family when like, oh, a mom has to like take care of everybody, or a single parent, or, and especially if you're coming from a low income family, like, you know,
yeah, one that's so income, true.
Relying on one income versus two, you know, it's like, so just that was kind of made me think bigger, like broadly that way of just what does that mean when the family is just struggling when there's no sense of stability.
That he's been really kind of thrown off balance by this loss, and then that throws everyone else off balance too because they're used to him being like the hub somehow.
Yeah. There's just a lot in the play that just kind of, I just recognized with those kids inside the juvenile halls, and just like I saw a lot of that in Junior. You know, I'm like, you know, what is Junior returning to, you know, from imprisonment to this another kind of like dysfunctional prison in a way, like that where he can't move forward or can't, there's no way for him to find comfort yet, you know, he's feeling the responsibility on his shoulders to take care. So there's just like that layer of father-son relationship that we don't really see. That the play was sort of playing around with, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's really true.
Yeah.
And then there's also the ring. I really like that the ring was introduced early in the play and came back at the end. And I was so fascinated by that scene where he, you know, he's like in the hospital bed at home and they're trying to get him to sign this settlement. And he's like ready to sign. And then he's like, but I also want your ring. And it's his engagement ring. And tie. Well, yeah, then there's the tie. But the tie feels like just an afterthought, like because now he clearly has that power. He's just going to rub it in their faces. But I don't know. There's something about like him taking this $30,000 ring that he's just going to give away.
Yeah. Which, okay, that threw me off in terms of like where like my – I'm not saying I'm rewriting this play or anything, but – I was like thinking like he was gonna like, okay, like he, there's the check, the ring he's gonna give to his son to propose to, like, and then the tie I thought he's gonna give to Oswaldo, like, go get yourself a job, kid. Uh-huh. You know? Like, I really thought there was like, if the setting up was like father provider / thing, like, I kind of was like expecting like this is his last hurrah, or like this is his last last moment of being a provider before he goes, like, because he's on his deathbed, you're like think he's gonna die,
right? Well, look at what he says. It's the last line of the play, because he's giving the ring to the church lady and she's like, there weren't any orphans. I just made that up to steal from you. And he says, well, there are orphans somewhere. Mm. It's like, I mean, it's very resonant on one hand, because like he is, it seems, trying to, you know, help the next generation. But on the other hand, like he says there are orphans somewhere as if he doesn't have these young people depending on him, like, right there.
And giving it to the church lady who lied. Like, how I don't trust that church lady.
Right. Yeah.
So like, because I'm like, because I don't know her intentions was just so weird and skewed and just all messed up throughout the play. So I'm like, you're giving this expensive ring to that one person you probably shouldn't give.
Right.
I don't know. I was like, I mean, that's what I'm calling it, dysfunctional. Like, this is so dysfunctional.
Yeah.
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 Oh, God.
But it on, like, just the dramaturgical level of, like, tracking a magical object, as Sherry Kramer would call it, that was very satisfying to me. That there's this ring that is imbued with all this emotional power and, like, financial value early in the play, and then it comes back at the very end. I liked that. Where do you think he goes?
He's like traveling.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, the only mention of other places was like Baltimore, right? So I'm like, I don't know if he's going that direction. Because I don't know if Junior and Pops has some history or relationship with Baltimore. I like to think he went out west to California.
I mean, it does kind of feel like by him leaving, he's breaking free of that feeling of being stuck that you were talking about earlier. Like, if by him leaving, somehow he can set himself free and everybody else free too. Like, they're no longer trapped in this cycle. Or not cycle, like, but just kind of stagnation. Yeah.
Right. But then you also have this, like, this Godot moment, waiting for Godot moment, where those three kids are just kind of like in the
waiting for
him to be back. When do you think he'll come back? I don't know.
Right. Right.
So you like leave. And then I think, because that was like a flashback or that moment at the end. So the kids are like, you know, he's been gone for 6 months or so. I think he died. He left and I think he died somewhere.
Yeah. And like, they're the orphans. And the last line of the play is, they're orphans somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very poignant.
Oof. But yeah, just before we move on to kind of like last questions and stuff, but the church lady, her character was like just, I can't even describe it. Like, out of this world, kind of like really weird and really naughty.
Well, and it turns out, she was just a scammer.
Yeah.
I know, that scene was so, it felt like it was a scene from another play. Like, the tone was different and.
Yeah, it was like, it got dark really fast.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a really interesting scene. And it was the only scene where it was like, it was just Pops and her. And there were none of the other characters from the rest of the play. And so maybe it was a good way to show us another window onto his character. Because he wasn't around anyone he knew. Or his family members.
All right.
I just like how I kept saying, this is impossible. This is medically impossible.
So last minute, or like last questions and curiosities that have come up for you?
What am I curious about? Well, I don't know. I mean, so this was written in like 2014, I guess, or 2015. obviously before Donald Trump became president. There's even a reference to Donald Trump. I'm just like, my biggest question is like, mm-hmm. how would the past 6 years have changed this story? You know, it just, it just feels like a, and it, I mean, it feels like it's older than 6 years old. It feels like it's from another time. Doesn't it just seem like, I don't know, like the Trump years were like a decade. And everything from before that, it feels really dated.
Whole other time. I think for me, this play felt a little relevant for me because only because the themes that it was all circling is just something that LA as a whole have been going through this last couple of years, three, 4 years, in terms of like homelessness, evictions, like the rise and like people leaving and just like you like walking down Venice Beach, you see encampments and, you know, people screaming and just like chaos and like really mentally disturbed people who really need help. You know, like there's just something, and I was like, this play made me think like, this was like, this play showing me like before you go homeless. Like, I don't know. It's just like, there's kind of this any ounce of like normalcy before you go there, like before you lose everything. You know, there's just like that, I don't know why, but there, it just like, all these emotions.
So does it seem like it's like there would be a whole other play after this? Like this is kind of the beginning of how things really go downhill for people.
It felt like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It kind of opened that window a little bit. And I was like, man. And I think this play was done in LA like a couple of years ago, maybe before the pandemic, maybe 2019. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, I didn't watch it or anything, but I'm like, I was curious to know like what the reaction was like for people who watched it in LA specifically. So, yeah, in terms of like the themes, like about what it means to own a home, I guess, in the most broader sense, like that's what this play made me think about more deeply.
Yeah.
But,
well, and what it means to be a cop too. There's so much in this play about like, what it does to you, what it does to a person, particularly to a black man, to be a cop for, I think it's just like 30 years.
Yeah.
And that also feels very timely.
So I have one last question.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say I have one last question before we move on to Glistens, but I was going to say, what did this place smell like to you?
What are they eating? Ring dings? I don't know. I just feel like
I don't know what that is.
I don't know, it's like some kind of like snack food. What did it smell like to you?
Like bourbon vanilla.
Ooh.
Very like sickly sweet, but like, you know, kind of toxic.
Like a sweet smell.
Smell.
Well, like, it doesn't it say something? Sweet. I'm looking at the beginning now. There's something in the beginning about
them drinking a lot, or
like in the opening. Oh yeah, in the opening stage directions, the place retains its dignity and charm. This is about the apartment, and the comforting aroma of decades of pot roasts and chicken dinners. So that too.
Yeah. I love how this play,
decades of pot roasts.
Really captured. The play was already started with sound, like smells. Like, I love it. Starting with smells. Cool.
All right. So, listeners, let us know what you thought of this play.
Yes, please.
And shall we move on to Glistens?
Yes. So, I could go first.
Okay.
My glisten this week is my brain. My brain is broken. No, it's not. But
it's not broken.
But you know, it was just like, okay, so I hate to mention this again, but my wedding. but I remember the day of. Remember you were like saying to me like, oh, you're going to have so much brain free space, you know, mm-hmm. after this wedding is over. Like, aren't you excited for that? I'm like, oh, you so much you could think and do. I was like, which was so true. Like, as soon as the wedding was over, I felt like, wow, my mind is so open, free. But then immediately it was filled up with like, oh, all these like deadlines that I had to do. And I was just like writing nonstop all week long. And now I feel brain dead. So,
but like your brain did what you needed it to do all week. It sounds like you were successful in doing all that writing, right?
Yeah, but I can't trust what I wrote. Like, I think they're really bad. So, but yeah, my brain, so. It was just kind of, so it's like so interesting, my experience, my brain feeling so open and free, and all of a sudden it's like busy and hectic and crazy, and I'm like, wow, Saturday, today, we're recording, and my brain is feeling just slow and dull. Mm. And
well, I just think also that's just like
pandemic.
The lingering effects of the pandemic. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. All right.
That's why people go on a honeymoon, Sarah, so they don't have to think for a week.
How are we going to do that?
After their wedding.
All right.
My lesson is that it is my birthday.
Woo!
Tomorrow, for people who are listening to this on Monday, the 12th. My birthday is on the 13th.
Wow.
Turning 34. Recently, I was reading like an old journal that I wrote when I was like 20, and I was like, I'm turning 21 soon. That is very old. I feel like every year I'm like, oh, now I'm really old. 34. If anyone out there listening to this is 34, tell me what your experience was like turning 34. I would love to know. My dad's coming to visit, which is really nice.
So question at this moment in your life, mm-hmm. How are you physically? Like, any aches?
You mean am I declining?
Just curious to know, because as soon as I turn 30, your knees are hurting.
Are they? Like, is that what you want to know?
I'm just curious because as soon as I turn 30, I've all had all these like pain. Came out of nowhere.
Just physical pain?
Yeah, physical pain. Like, back pains, shoulder pains, just like random things that came out of nowhere. More grays, like pain.
Maybe you should go to a doctor.
Okay.
Like I'm pretty healthy.
Okay.
But I'll let you know.
Okay, keep me posted.
Okay.
All right, listeners, thanks for listening. As always, like, subscribe, do what you gotta do. And talk to you next time.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.